Falls to your left. Okay, discussion, call for discussion. Let me call for discussion 12 now. We're in the 12.
we have more important things we need to deal with.
Okay.
So the other, the mystics and the rationalists, read that over. You read about those in Light of Red. So I'm not going to go over that in class. I want to begin now, discussion 13, page 66, with the Reformation in England. This is quite interesting. So this is where we are, page 66. Henry VIII, look what I put in capital letters. Henry VIII, the Reformation in England, what we have is schism without heresy. The Reformation in England was different than the Reformation of the land. Now, the Reformation took different shapes in the countries that we've studied thus far. It took various shapes, has it not? The wars in Germany, the Huguenot persecution in France, John Knox in Scotland, the Calvinian and Zwinglian movements in Switzerland. In England, it was different. Henry VIII had, as we indicated, England was ringing with the ideas of Wycliffe, John Duns Scotus, William of Ockham, Lollardy, the movement that Wycliffe started, persisted, especially among the poor. And the Roman Catholic Church was exceedingly corrupt. The humanists were there, they were reading the writings of Erasmus and Thomas More and Colet and others. The English, there was in England a rising and emerging nationalism that began to think of themselves as English, didn't like the Pope. The writings of Luther and Calvin reached Oxford, the university complex at Oxford. The Tudor monarchs were building an absolute monarchy, and they wanted independence, just like everybody else wanted independence, except the French, and they had it on their own terms. The religion, the state church, they had it on their own terms. Rome was not a particular threat. England was one of the areas into which Latin Christianity came late. It had never been Latinized. We talked about this last quarter. The Latin culture had never been fixed in England. This brings us to Henry VIII and his famous divorce. There was on public television, is ever so often, this series, Henry VIII. You ought to watch it. It's really interesting. Have you seen it? What happened was, keep in mind that Henry's concern, the War of the Roses had been fought. Henry's concern was keeping England together. England had gone through a series of civil wars and couldn't take much more. If England had gone into one more civil war, it's likely that France would have come in and taken over. Or Spain. Let me see, Elizabeth fought the Spaniards. So, what he had to have, now listen, what Henry had to have to maintain, to make sure that England would not descend into chaos was a If he did not have a son who was a clear heir to the throne, then the various factions would try to get their own person on the throne, and what would be the result? War. So one thing. So he was really thinking for England. Henry VII, his father, had arranged the marriage of his oldest son, whom we know as Henry VIII, to Catherine of Aragon, Spain. Now, that is to form an alliance. This is a court marriage, we call it. Spain was a leading world power, and it's a good way to make an ally, mainly against France. Got that? And as an ally against France, always threatening England. So, Spain was the wonder of the ages, we've seen. Arthur, to whom she was married, the son of Henry VII, died. And he had a choice. He could either send her back along with her dowry, which is a lot of money, and lose the alliance, or he could keep the alliance and keep the money. And so he had her married, arranged the marriage, to marry his second son, Henry VIII, as we know him. She was 24, he was 18. Got that? So really, she was married to his brother. Now, it was against the canon law, against the church law, for a man to marry his wife's brethren. But Henry the Seventh,
I say this because the last one they made of it later.
And so he arranged the marriage, paid the dispensation, paid the Pope some money, and he agreed to waive the restriction. And so Catherine was married to Henry. Now, it was not a love affair, but most of them weren't in those days. They lived together for 17 years.
Were they in love?
No. Henry finally asked for a divorce. Why? Because, he wanted a divorce because she could not give him a son. Children all died. Most of them died, and the sons died, and he needed a son. Henry VIII needed a son. He asked the Pope for a divorce. He gave the Pope two reasons. He said his conscience was hurting because he had married his brother's wife. After 17 years, his conscience finally got the best of him. He said the fact that he did not have a son was a judgment. You think he really did think that the wrath of God was upon that marriage? That's very likely. Probably did think that. I wasn't just making that up. He said, look, obviously God is not blessing this. And maybe we shouldn't have got married in the first place, because she was my brother's wife. And he needed a male heir. Well, and he had a mistress, Anne Boleyn. Now that was not particularly, don't get all soap opera-ish in your mind. He had a mistress, but that was also SOP. That was no great scandal. The king did that. It had his wife, but he had a mistress, Anne Boleyn. And that was not different. You understand? That didn't cause a lot of raised eyebrows or anything. She was pregnant with his child. He wanted to marry her, legitimize the baby. Why? Because the babies he was having by his wife, Catherine, certainly weren't living. One daughter lived, and it wasn't say here, I'll list that for you. All but one daughter died. We're going to meet her later. What some people say is, some history books say, fell in love with Anne Boleyn, and loving Anne Boleyn, he wanted to divorce his wife. That is not true. He did not want to divorce. The idea of marrying, that you have to be in love with your wife, and you wanted to marry a woman you love, did not occur to them. Not the same way it does in the modern sense. You know what I mean? He was talking divorce long before he began playing slap and tickle with Anne Boleyn. For the reasons I've given, understand? The wrath of God was on the marriage, he needed the male heir. Now, as I point out the syllabus, Anne Boleyn, I'm going to sit down, I'm tired. Anne Boleyn was only 7 years old when he started talking divorce. You got that? She was still a little girl before anything ever happened between them. She was 7 years old. So, sometimes these public presentations try to picture, he loves Anne Boleyn and he wants to have. There's no connection between his love for Anne Boleyn and his wanting a divorce. That's a modern idea imposed on an age that did not think that way. Understand, that's modern, so it's a modern soap opera. What would the Pope say? Now, again, it was not unusual for the Pope to grant the dispensation for the divorce. It was not unusual for him to have a mistress. And he petitioned, he said, well, he didn't want a divorce in the modern sense. He wanted a marriage annulled. Why should everything take place in the first place? You, my brother's wife. And this request for an annulment was not all that unusual. Got that? That was standard operating procedure. It was common for the church for a fee to find some flaw. However, the problem is that if, here's the problem, if the Pope, keep in mind we've already studied how the Pope was threatened by the power of Spain and trying to hold off the rising power of Spain.
You were beheaded. If you were Protestant, you were burned. You were Catholic, but not Roman Catholic. Got that? The doctrines were the same, except you did not recognize the authority of the Pope of Rome over the Church of England. You could affirm the authority of the Pope of Rome over the Church of France, or any other country, Italy, but not England. Understand? Are we Catholic? Yes. Are we Roman? No. Are we Protestant? No. So in the beginning, you got that? You were Roman, you held for Rome and beheaded it as a traitor, listen to me, as a traitor to the state. You got me? Anybody who declared for Rome could be, was subject, they didn't do all, they didn't kill everybody, but they were subject to being beheaded. The Church of England became neither Protestant nor Roman Catholic in the beginning. Okay. Do y'all get that? It's quite interesting. Well, we're going to see that once the authority of the Pope was repudiated, however, then they were on their way to Protestantism. Henry thought he could remove the authority of the Pope of Rome and yet maintain a Catholic Church. And it couldn't. Two important things happened, I listed during the reign of Henry VIII, that had a direct and long-range impact on the church. Number one, the destruction of the land over the monasteries. He could not be king of England and let the monasteries remain independent, because that was as much as two-fifths, some say three-fifths of England. Now their land, the land was their primary source of wealth. And the monks were the greatest supporters of the papacy. The centers, that is, it was the monks in the monasteries who were the most Catholic and most faithful to the Pope, not the bishops and the priests and the churches. So when he closed down the monastery, the monks were the best supporters of the papacy. They were very wealthy. He closed down the monastery, took over their estates. This broke the power of Rome and England. Because second sons, or their estates had fallen into bad times. Remember the Crusades? One of the motives for the Crusades was to do what? To find estates for our nobles who didn't have any land, who were entitled to it by birth, but in the sense that they were of noble blood, but there was nothing for them to inherit. So he took these vast papal monastic estates, he picked out certain nobles in the land, and he made them men by giving them land and gave them a vested interest in what came to be the Reformation. Were they going to support the papacy? Hardly. What if they did support the papacy? What would the papacy do? Take the land back. What would happen to them? They'd go back to being what they were, broke and unimportant. You can see that. That's very smart, wasn't it? He gave it to these. So for these reasons, number one, because the monasteries were the centers of true papal support in England, and the power of the papacy was in the monasteries, and because he destroyed that by taking over the monasteries and by creating a power base by giving it to these by creating his landed nobles, then he broke the power of the Roman Catholic Church in England, the political power. It's the true fist, the real power. Secondly, there arose a true Protestant party, religiously speaking. Remember I've taught you, we've already studied, that this thinking, what we call Reformation thinking, was very much in England, it's in the air, being talked about. This was the land of Wycliffe. So, now, but note this, Henry did not want that. Henry was not interested in Protestant theology. But the seedbed was there. William Tyndale, he translated the New Testament to English from the Greek text. He was the first one to do so. First one to translate into English. Archbishop Cranmer, he was more Protestant than he told Henry. Didn't let on to Henry. Got that? He wanted some Protestant ideas, justification by faith, other things. But he didn't say anything about it while Henry was alive, because Cranmer was the Archbishop of Canterbury, the leading bishop of the Church of England, now it's called. And as soon as Henry died, he came out for genuine Reformation. So, but when Henry died, a later wife he got, Jane Seymour, gave him a son, and it was by this son, we know as Edward VI, who came to the throne, and the Reformation began with Edward, the true Reformation began with Edward. Got that? You had schism with Henry. But you begin to have a reform in religious doctrine with his son, Edward VI. Okay. He ascended the throne. Look at the statement I made. Under Edward VI, England moved from schism to what? Heresy. That is, as the Roman Church would define it. Edward came to the throne at 9. He died at age 16, unfortunately. So since he was young, he was under a protection. He had a very good humanist Renaissance education. He was trained in the classics, very well educated, and he was very intelligent.
Was it common for
Yes. If they were born to the throne, even if they were a baby, what they would do is, if they were a baby, they would come to the throne. But they would, until they came of age, the country would be ruled by a regent, often the mother. We saw this in Scotland. We saw this in Scotland, remember, when you were 6. We studied in Scotland, remember, Mary, Queen of Scotland, ruled by a regent. Now, good question. I think about 13 or 14. I'm not sure about that. But before he died at age 16, he actually was in power before he died. He died at age 16. And that was not all uncommon. But while he was, with his blessing, Parliament took over to do what the Scottish Parliament had done, and that is to define the state church. What the worship would be, what the faith would be. And you can read that. It enforced the Act of Uniformity, 1549, was an act of Parliament dictating all worship and uniformity. It says, if we now have, learn this, students, I know you're getting tired of it.
work, stay with me.
If you now
have one of the state churches going to function. The Book of Common Prayer is that this uniform worship. And in contrast to the Lutheran and Calvinian movement, the Church of England from the beginning was little interested in theology. They wanted the uniform liturgy. And so a new act of uniformity, the Second Book of Common Prayer of Edward VI is called, was established. And it is the basis of the present prayer book of England. It was more Protestant in its wording. It was the work of Cranmer and Ridley, one of the great documents in the history of the church, a devotional classic. Look at this last statement, underline it. More than the Bible, the second book of common prayer of Edward VI was the book upon which the English Reformation was based. Got that? The first book was too Catholic for Cranmer's taste, and so they made it more Protestant. The second prayer book, while Edward was king, so it's called the second prayer book of Edward VI.
Evolving into the Anglican.
Yes, and becoming the Anglican or Episcopal Church, as we think of it. You
know, maybe we'll touch on this later, but the Episcopal Church today seems to have reverted back more than the
Well, we're going to talk about there's not one Episcopal Church, there's really three, high, middle, and low church. Some of it has, right? High church. Okay. Okay, then Parliament drew up what's called the 42 Articles in 1552. It was a brief confession of faith. Then it was reduced to 39. It was a simple and non-theological, underline that, presentation of the faith of the Church of England. In no way did it represent the kind of theological definition found in the Formula of Concord, Lutheran. They are mildly Calvinistic, and these 39 articles are still found in the Episcopal Prayer Book. In Zurich and Zwingli? Absolutely not. They went all the way. Got this? It is the Via Media, the middle way, the compromise. Is it really Catholic? No. Is it really Protestant? No. What is it? Both? Neither? Hard to say. Am I teaching you anything? Even today, in the present form, what is the Episcopal Church? Is it Protestant? Well, not exactly. Kind of. Or is it Catholic? Well, in a manner of speaking, what is it? Well, it's both. No, it's neither. What is it? Hard to say. Get the point? That's what it was. And it started out like with Henry VIII, you see. He had a Church of England. What was it? You say it's Roman, you're beheaded. You say it's Protestant, you're burned. What is this? The Church of England. It's the grand anomaly. If you think in terms of Roman Catholic, and you follow me, and Protestant, and if by Protestant you mean what you see in Germany and Switzerland and Scotland, then it's not Protestant. But it's got to be Protestant. Why? It's not Catholic. The Church of England became Protestant only in the sense it was not Catholic. Was it Catholic? Well, if you mean Roman Catholic, no. Do they have apostolic succession? Yes. Do they have a pope? Y'all getting the idea?
Yeah.
That's why it's called Via Media, the middle way.
This, the Church of England comes to be, now it's going to change its shape here. We're not through with it yet. So, but we're going to see, it comes to be neither Catholic nor Protestant, both Catholic and Protestant. Kind of both, a little bit of neither.
It's the middle way.
Yes,
Lord.
Then, what happened when Edward died? Mary, another came to the throne, and we know her as Bloody Mary. She came to the throne. She was the oldest daughter of Henry VIII and Catherine. She was the one who lived, unfortunately, some would say. Now, what would you expect her religion to be? Her mother was the daughter of the King of Spain. She was madder than hop. She had been branded illegitimate by the church, not by the Pope, but by the Church of England. And when she came to the throne, she was going to restore England to Rome or die trying. And keep in mind that the Reformation had not filtered down to the common people. It had all been done in Parliament. A lot of men that the country had been declared Protestant. Mary simply declared the Church of England is now under the Roman Pontiff. Got that? She simply declared, you know, declared that England, and she restored legally by decree. And therefore, she burned, and she only, she didn't reign very long, 5 years, mercifully. During the last 2 years of her reign, she burned approximately 300 Protestants at the stake. Now, and they gave her the epithet Bloody Mary because she burned to kill 300 Protestants. Now listen, as Protestants go, as burning people go, 300 were burned out. When you think of what happened in Germany, when you think of what happened to the Huguenots in France, think about that. Think of the Huguenots in France. Think of the Anabaptists. Bloody Mary, because, as I say, many Protestants were spread to the continent. This is when John Knox left. Remember you said that last week, or earlier in the week. Although I say, well, this was not a particularly large number, because of when it was, because of the age, because these were leading men. This, because things had changed. This really. Even though, listen to me, the common people were not won over yet. This, at the time it came and the way it happened, this really struck the people as being gory, as being the thing that was not, that should not have been done. You know, it just really had an impact way above its numbers because of the age. Why? Well, because the people were not ready for that. It was, and to have the Spanish, this daughter of the King of Spain, granddaughter of the King of Spain, kill Englishmen. One thing, you see, if one Englishman killed 5,000 English heretics, that would have been bad, but not bad. But to have a Spaniard killing 300 leading Englishmen, that's good. You understand? Depending on the set. Today, one worker
died of radioactive poisoning in a nuclear power plant. One American, one worker, I'm sorry, one worker died today in a nuclear power plant, the media would go crazy. It would be written up, there would be commissions, the liberals in Congress would pitch a hissy. There would be a furor raised, demand that we... Seven people die in a spacecraft at one time, and it becomes a national tragedy. 7,000 people can die one here and one there on the highways or because of alcoholism or drugs. And, you know, there's no logic to death. A baby fag is the heart of a baboon. And she dies, and it's written up, and there's mourning, and little children write letters. On the day that baby Faye died, several hundred of the unborn were killed. Who mourned then? See what I'm saying? It just depends on how you look at it, and what mood you're in, and what your cultural assumptions are. The illogic of death. And I mean, since the we're a part of it, we're part of the same thing. So, what I'm trying to help you understand is, without going into all the details, she was called Bloody Mary, but by what we've been studying the last few days, it seemed bloody at all. 300, doesn't it? You understand? It didn't seem like anything. But it was just the way that the timing of it, and the national mood, when this granddaughter of Spain killed these Englishmen, it really hurt the. It really helped the revolution. As one author put it, look at this. This is a statement. The English people have never been able to get the fires of Smithfield out of their nostrils. That's where they were burned. 300 leaders were burned. The English people have never been able to get that stench out of their nose. Back then, you know the common... Stories of the martyrdoms was written up by Fox. You were written up. And his book was rightly written. Remember Fox's book of martyrdoms? It came out, and people all of a sudden became very indignant about this. All of a sudden. Anyway. Among those burned were bishops Latimer and Ridley. Only these were bishops of the Church of England who were Protestant. Mary had them put to death. Latimer is recorded as saying to his companion, this is one of the great stories in church history. Latimer is recorded as saying to his companion at the stake, they could see one another, and were setting them on fire, and he says, "Be of good comfort, Master Ridley. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace." Latimer and Ridley and these other men on fire at Smithfield. That was never, that could never be put out. Cranmer was in a dilemma. Cranmer had been convinced that the sovereign of England was the rightful head of the church. That was fine as long as it was Edward. He was Protestant. But Mary was, see, understand, theologically he felt he should support Mary, and yet he couldn't.